And this is Robert St. John. And our Christmas reunion continues now with visits to Hollywood and Stockholm. The next hour will bring you a wounded soldier fighting his way to recovery in order to get back and fight. Some original music written by American prisoners of war. And a brief performance by the NBC Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Dr. Leopold Stokowski. But now, continuing our Christmas reunion program from New York, we bring you a story by the lady who made the wish.
I would like you to imagine that I am Martha Summers, a British newspaper woman visiting this country. She has a story to tell you, and this is how it goes. It was a Saturday afternoon at the Savoy in London. I had come down from Manchester to do a piece on General Borden, now in supreme command of the British forces in a certain area. The young American staff sergeant first caught my attention as we entered the cocktail lounge, perhaps because he was alone. The only other chair at his table held his carefully placed overcoat and cap. And because it happened to be in the way as we seated ourselves, our waiter quickly and silently moved that chair to the other side of the American sergeant's table. I noticed that he had finished his lonely snack and was sipping a brandy. And then my thoughts returned to my own party. There were six of us, three subalterns, oh, so anxious to please the great man to whom they had been assigned as junior staff officers, a major, not quite so obvious in his anxiety, and the great General Borden himself, terrifyingly impressive in his Bond Street uniform and heavy gold braid. But the general would have been equally impressive in coveralls, I thought to myself as we ordered cocktails. There was a calculating hardness about those handsome blue eyes, which told you things instantly about the brain behind them. It would be logical in the face of any storm. It would be reasonable, and always completely unaffected by emotion of any sort. This was the man who would certainly become the world's greatest modern military leader. This was the man I had been sent down to London to interview. Truly a man of steel. We talked at some length until I had completed my notes. Then the conversation took a more casual tone. Only then did I become conscious of the music. Only then did I again become aware of the American staff sergeant, whose silver wings I could see now as he had turned a little to listen. The pianist was playing something of George Gershwin's, whom I had always admired. And as I, too, listened, I watched the young American's face. He stared straight before him, his mind called home, perhaps, by the sound of a familiar melody. The song was ended, and the American stood up, placing a few coins on the table. Then he turned and reached down to where his overcoat and cap had been before we arrived. He groped. Then again. And almost fell. Surely, I thought, the boy can see that the chair has been... And suddenly, I knew that he was blind. So did everyone else in that room, and they watched him curiously, not without sympathy, but with that strange coldness which is common to a crowd, always waiting for someone else to do something. He groped again, and I thought, good heavens, where is the waiter? I looked sharply at one of the young subalterns, and the glance he threw back at me seemed to say, dignity, please. We must preserve our dignity. But the great general had seen that glance, and half turning, he took in the meaning of the scene in a moment. He got up quickly and walked around the American's table to the extra chair, picked up the boy's things, and returned to his side as we stared unbelieving. Your coat, sir. He helped the boy into the heavy garment with all the deft sureness of the perfectly trained gentleman's gentleman. Your cap, sir. The general pressed it into the blind American's grasp. A pause, and then, your stick, sir. As the American took his cane, he fumbled for something in his overcoat pocket. He pressed a coin into General Borden's hand. The great man's bow was more for the occasion than for the boy who could not see him, but only we at that table were near enough to catch his words, which were meant only for the young American. The general said, thank you, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Then my eyes filled, and I could see no better than the boy who had been so kindly and humbly served by the Man of Steel.
Out there, skillful American Army surgeons have picked some 15 pieces of steel out of his body since last fall. He is Corporal Andrew Ruskansky, who beat death to the punch and got home in time to marry his best girl so that both of them could have Christmas dinner with the family. Corporal Ruskansky is waiting for us at Halron General Hospital.
We are speaking to you from Halloran General Hospital in Willowbrook, Staten Island, New York. Just to make Bob St. John's introduction a little more complete, Corporal Andrew Ruskansky, seated beside me here, is a fine-looking young man, 22 years old. That right, Corporal?
The age is correct, Mr. Sherry.
I thought the girls might be interested in further description.
Trouble with that is that I'm only interested in one girl, and that's my wife, Frances.
Okay, enough of description then. And if you don't mind, Corporal Ruskansky, I'm going to let you do most of the talking in order to keep the ball rolling. Suppose you start by telling us the why, the when, and where of things.
Well, I signed up with the United States Army Air Forces in Newark, New Jersey on December 12, 1941. That was 5 days after Pearl Harbor, so now you know why I joined.
I get it.
I was to be an airplane mechanic. I took my basic and other schooling at Keesler Field, Mississippi. And for further training, I was sent out to Burbank, California. I went to England in June 1942 to join my outfit, a fighter group. And we landed in Africa with the invasion forces on November 8th.
Under fire, were you?
No, Bob, not that time. The Rangers had already cleared the beaches.
Well, then what happened, Corporal Ruskansky?
Well, we were all through the Tunisian campaign and narrowly missed getting caught during that famous retreat through the Kasserine Pass. We were providing air cover for our troops, remember? So we were the last out.
But I should think with planes to take in...
We're mechanics. See, strictly ground crew. We don't fly. When we have to get out, we get out on the ground.
I see. Now, Bob St. John, in mentioning your injuries, said that the surgeons had removed some 15 pieces of shell fragment from your body, Corporal.
That's approximately correct, although I think I still have one piece with me. That's one of the reasons why I'm still here at Halloran General Hospital.
And one of the reasons why I'm here is to ask you to tell us about it. Do you mind?
Well, I don't mind talking about it. It was a day I'll never forget.
I guess not. Well, how did it happen?
Well, with three other fellows, I'm the crew chief, we were out on a line servicing our plane. It was 6:30 on the morning of June 7th, 1943, and our fighter group was getting ready to take off on a mission. Off to one side of the field, there was a cliff, and we heard the roar of the Messerschmitt squadron just as it came over the rise. We hit the ground fast.
But they got you anyway.
No, sir. It didn't happen then. The Messerschmitts weren't after us especially. They bombed and strafed the field, and we stayed put. And then they came back for a second run and headed home.
And then what?
Well, my crew, all of us, got up and dusted ourselves off, making the kind of jokes we usually make after a little excitement like that. Our plane was all revved up and ready for its job, so I started off across the field to get some breakfast. I got a few feet away from my crew when three Fokker Wolfs came in low over the rise. I twisted to look at one of them so close to the ground that the pilot and I were staring at each other for a split second. I remember thinking when he grinned at me that he had a nice set of teeth. But he had something else. He had a 50-pound fragmentation bomb, and he let go as he went by. His two mates did the same, and so far as I'm concerned, that was it.
Plus 6 months in hospitals in Africa and here. Now tell us, Corporal Ruskansky, you'll be able to leave Halloran General Hospital pretty soon, won't you?
I don't know how soon, Mr. Cherry. The doctors still have designs on the nerve of my leg.
And after that?
It's up to Uncle Sam, and I notice our time's almost up. Would it be all right if I send a greeting to my old outfit? They're in Italy now.
It wouldn't make much difference where they are, because this is a worldwide network. Go ahead, Corporal. It's on the house.
Merry Christmas, gang. Keep them flying. I hope to see you back soon.
From Halloran General Hospital, we return you to Robert St. John in our New York studios.
California, here I come, and my time is your time. Couldn't be advance musical notice for anyone but Lieutenant Rudy Valley, who is waiting for us with the United States Coast Guard Band in Hollywood. Thank you.
Thank you. Following the prelude to Humperdinck's opera Hansel and Gretel, Mr. Stokowski and the NBC Symphony Orchestra are heard playing the Shepherd's Music from the Christmas Oratorio of Bach.